Good afternoon, good morning, good day, depending on where you're listening from. Welcome to Profit and Beauty. Now, this show was created for salon owners who have decided to start running their salons like a business rather than a hustle. The focus of the show is to help salon owners understand the numbers behind their business so that they can grow and make extraordinary profits. Without this knowledge, it's really hard, if not impossible, for your salon to reach its true potential. My name is Desiree Anderson, and I have 19 years experience as a hairstylist and salon owner. I currently work as a certified public accountant, working mainly with salon owners and hairstylists. My background as a former stylist and salon owner gives me a much better understanding of what our industry professionals need and desire. So if you are a hairstylist or salon owner interested in running your salon like a business, then this show is for you. On the other hand, if you are a hairstylist or salon owner not interested in running your salon like a business, this show may or may not be for you. I just hope you keep listening and maybe something you hear in one of the episodes will make you decide to turn your craft from a hustle into a business that you can scale and grow. So sit back and enjoy this week's episode. All right, so hi everyone and welcome back to Profit and Beauty. On today's show, I have a very special guest from the world of beauty products. Now, I think it's a very important topic, if for no other reason than for the importance of diversifying your income streams. As hairstylists, it's important to try and minimize as much as possible your dependence on the money you make behind the chair and on the money that your booth renters or commission stylists bring in, because we all know how temperamental stylists can be, and they'll have no problem walking out on you on any given day. So my guest on today's show is Margaret Haven. Margaret's career started as a lab technician for the Atlanta Water Works. And in the late 70s, she became part of the team developing the first no-lie relaxer. Now, this position afforded her the opportunity to see how a product is developed, manufactured, and positioned in the marketplace. Today, Margaret serves as the founder and the CEO of the Haven Research Center, also called HRC for short. HRC is a research, development, training, and manufacturing company focusing on eco-friendly personal care and food products. Hi, Margaret.
Hello.
Hi. I would like to, first of all, start by thanking you for being a guest or agreeing to be a guest on today's show. And also, can you tell the audience anything about yourself that I left out?
How long do we have? First of all, thank you for having me. It's a plus to speak to people in the industry who really want to do entrepreneurship in any division. I did many things, and this was before. Back in the day, we would call it job hopping or couldn't keep a job or whatever. I did that for a purpose. I wanted to learn different aspects of the business because I knew I was going to go into business. I just didn't know which type of business I was going to go into. So I was honored to work with a group of people. Generally, it was scientists, non-scientists, just the whole group, gambit. In the laboratory, we produced a product similar to what they call the Jerry Curl. It was a thio-based product.
I remember those.
You remember that?
Yes.
I had an opportunity to, one company I worked with, and he said he was looking for a plant manager, and I started naming people, and he said, why not you? And I'm like, what? Wow. You have to understand, this is in the mid-80s for a female to become a plant manager. That was one of the better jobs I had. It took me out of the lab, per se, and helped me to manage and maintain a manufacturing facility. Since that time, I've been the plant manager two other times. And again, I like that. I work with major companies to startup companies, develop product to quality control, which I hated, but God had a plan. When you work in quality control, you're working with every division, okay? So therefore, I had insight to what they call now supply chain, finance, manufacturing, production, personnel. So it's the whole gamut of things. So I'm blessed.
Well, that's good. So let's jump right in. Now, mm-hmm. at the top of the show, I mentioned the importance of income diversification mm-hmm. as it relates to shoring up, you know, multiple streams of income. So tell me and my audience, or rather, me and the audience, I shouldn't say my audience, I don't own them. So tell me and the audience what it actually takes to start a cosmetic business. Because I've seen several stylists that I've worked with in the past start their own product line, and I always wondered how they did it.
Okay, it's good that you're promoting starting your own business, because you can only do but so much. You have to diversify yourself or spread yourself out or into other people and other product. The first thing is have a good concept. Now, or exactly what is it you're trying to do or want to do and who your target market. Because I said the first thing first is really your marketing. Who are you trying to reach? What problem or problems are you trying to solve? Then you go into the idea of how can I make it happen? And you could start, most people, what they do, they kind of like kitchen chemistry, you know, mix some things up in the chair or they notice something. But I tell you, take a notebook with you and note the product that you use and what you get out of it. That's going to be your backbone. That's going to be your research and development for giving you ideas of how to make a product. Now, it's a long road. It's not easy, like starting up anything else. But if this is where your heart is and what you want to do, then you go for it.
Okay, so since you mentioned that, when I used to be a stylist, the one thing, if I could produce one product, it would have been something to get rid of dandruff, because it was such a pervasive problem. A lot of customers that came in had dandruff, and you know, they would go to the doctors and the doctors would prescribe different shampoos for them, but nothing really actually works. And I don't know if it didn't work because we weren't really using it as often as we should, because normally if you have dandruff, what I noticed was a lot of the prescriptions would say you have to shampoo your hair, you know, at least once or twice a week, and sometimes even every day for it to be effective. But most of our style, you know, most of our customers will come in once every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So it was impossible, you know, to really solve that problem. So if I had a magic wand, it would be to be able to produce a product that I can use on my clients that will alleviate dandruff. And I know if I could do that, I could just sit back and just, you know, collect the money that's going to come in, that's going to rain in from that particular idea, because it's such a huge problem when it comes to, you know, especially with women in the Black community. It was such a big issue. So basically what you're saying is that, and I guess my question was, how hard, what is it to start a product? And you're basically saying that the first thing you need to do is figure out the problem you're trying to solve and then go from there.
Yeah, and generally, and I believe everybody's a scientist. Again, I was just talking to some young high school students recently, and I said, you know, science is everywhere. That's how nerdy I am. That's how I feel about it. We do some type of form of scientist and not thinking about it, because the first thing you say, you notice, okay, that's a scientific thing. So what is it, every time they come in the chair, or is it some foods that they had ate? Really what you're doing, you're gathering facts, or information rather, let's put this, information, and then you're going to turn them into facts. So you say if one product that you wanted to make and help relieve the dryness or the flakiness from the scalp, then you will look at it and you start doing research. You try to figure out what did they do before. Is it irritation from the ingredients? So that's why you take notes. And you, because dandruff or flakiness of skin can come from many things. It could be hereditary, could be the products that they're using, could be hormonal. So it's a lot of information. Now they do have some ingredients that have been known to help, quote unquote, alleviate some of the product. Zinc pyridine and zinc armadine is one of them. And you see that in most of the shampoos that you see in the field today. They've used different type of ointments. But then again, that's what we do. We sit down and gather information that you have. And this is the first step the person should do. Besides coming to me and say, this seems to be a problem. This is what I observed. and then we go from there.
Okay, so once they gather the information, mm-hmm. Let's assume that, okay, I've determined everything that I need to determine. In other words, I've figured out what the issue was. I've taken my notes. I've sort of determined why my client is suffering from, whether it be dry scalp or dry, whatever the case may be, mm-hmm. flaky scalp or their hair is dry. Do I then take that information and then bring it to a person like yourself, and then you look at it, and then based upon the fact finding, you come up with the different ingredients?
Yeah. Basically, that's it. You bring it to the side. You try to bring as much information as possible, because if not, they're going to charge you for doing the research themselves. Okay, yeah. But you try to bring in as much information, and this is what you see. And then you say, well, this is what I want. And you give them a parameter. I want it to be this and to be that. Now, for example, someone did come to me recently and asked me to make an anti-itch. You got to use that term, anti-itch, because it's FDA, of course, the FDA barriers now. But you say that, and one of the things she said, well, I need a moisturizing shampoo after they put this shampoo in. You were removing the dandruff or the dryness. She said, but I need a moisturizing shampoo to lower the pH. But she said, but really, she told me this recently. She said, but really, your shampoo doesn't harden the hair. See, you could give it some direction, but a lot of things have changed. She's used to most of the shampoos when she used previously, the anti-itch or the dandruff removal or whatever title she wants to give it, is that it hardened the hair. I said, no, but mine doesn't harden the hair. So you try to give some information as much as you can, mm-hmm. but it doesn't mean that the outcome is going to be the same. She was thinking that you need, because it was drying the scalp, and that's the double-edged sword, I guess, is that in some cases they remove the dandruff, but the hair was, scalp was dry. But it doesn't have to be that way, because as new ideas start circulating, new ingredients circulate also.
Okay, so. Yeah. And I can definitely relate to that, because I know when, with the shampoos that were, I don't know if this is still the case, mm-hmm. but usually the shampoos that help to fight dry, itchy scalp mm-hmm. tend to be very stripping.
Yeah, that's what she, that's
yes.
What she,
so yeah. they usually strip all the moisture out, so we have to go back with a hydrating shampoo to put the moisture back in.
Yeah, that's it. But the one I made for, she said, but it doesn't do that.
Okay.
I said, yeah, I know. You know, it's just like, you know how you used to make something. I talk about food a lot. Even the food was my major field. But I use that because most people can relate to it. You know, back in the day, it may have been one way. My sister used to say, one when you used to cook peas, it looked like it took all day long. But they may have done something to the peas, modified it, and now you don't have to do that. So you take every, it's good to know what happened in the past. But then, because what I did basically with the shampoo was I put a lot of moisture ingredients in it.
Okay.
Yeah, because she said it was dry, so I put moisture ingredients. So therefore, now you don't need three steps.
Okay. So basically, what I'm hearing is, in order to start a product line, you mm-hmm. have to come up with the idea, mm-hmm. and then come to a person like yourself and say, here is what I need. Mm-hmm. Can you make it for me? And then you make the products, and then sort of goes from there, correct?
Yes. Uh-huh. And we okay, go back so, and forth. And you have to, the thing is, you have to write down everything you like. And there's some other products out there too, as part of your research. So you say, I like this product X, but this part I don't like about it. Product B, I like this. So you're gathering facts, and you take it to the quote unquote problem solver. I said, okay, this is what I want. This is how I want it to look. So.
Okay. So once a person decides to start their own product line, okay. Mm-hmm. So how do they make the decision between creating a private label versus purchasing their own formulas for their products? And also, what is the difference between the two options?
Okay. There's so much involved, and you in business yourself, you understand. There's different areas that you're going to find that you have an expertise in. If your expertise is selling, and then you might want to focus on that and say, let me have somebody make the product. Making product, let me backtrack. People see on Google and see people are making product. Yeah. Most of those products are anhydrous. They don't have any water. It's just like I call it like a dump mix, like a cake dump mix. Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about pH balance. Generally, you don't have to worry about preservative. I said the P word. Yeah. You don't have to.
That's a curse word around here.
I know. Go ahead. You don't have to worry about the science to it. You know, it just, like I said, you know, nitrogen is good and glycerin is good, but when the two of them get together, it's, you know, something else. So you don't have to worry about any of that. You don't have to. So you're making a dump formula. You just Kool-Aid, boom. When you start talking about other things, you need to read up to date. You need to read, make sure what FDA.gov say, not .org, not .com, FDA.gov, do they have anything about it? You need to talk to the vendors who are actually selling the product. The product, raw ingredients that you're getting online or some other places, they basically a reseller. They're not the tech community. Resellers, people who just get a job, take a drum and split the drum into two or three different things. So you need to get more involved. If that's not your expertise, then I would suggest you go. You don't have to go to me. Go to someone like me. Go to a company that would they learn, they gather that. This is their living. Their living comes from making formulas. So, but if you're making like a shea butter with some essential oils in it, well, you know, the chances are you're not going to run into too much of a problem.
But, okay. Go ahead. Okay, so you're saying with a private label, you say those are the ones that are just generic?
Private label, yeah. Private label, what does it call it? Contract packaging, they go by different names. But generally, they go a couple of ways. They may, let me backtrack. When you come to a product, person, you have to come with your formula you already got. You made it, you give it to them, and they manufacture it. Or you go to them and say, I want a formula like XYZ. And so they buy the formula and they recall it now, reverse engineer, or they make it for you. Or you have a formula already that you made, and then you give it to them, and then they modify it, per se. If they modify it, then the formula belongs to them. Or if it's okay, they can make it, then they go from there. So you want to figure out what exactly you want to do. People get frightened because of the cost. A formula costs $3,500 plus. People say, oh, it's a lot. And it is a lot if you don't have it. You know, $10 is a lot if you don't have it.
Exactly.
But what you try to do, you try to figure out a payment plan and you go from there. But the guarantee of them taking that away from you, there's a lot to just making a formula. You have to make sure your inline specifications are okay. They should give you more information. Some people say I could go on Google and find it. I said, well, if that's what you choose to do, go ahead and go on Google. But some of that stuff is erroneous. Okay. So, go ahead.
So you're saying with a formula, you can buy a formula, uh-huh, and the formula will cost you about $3,500.
Plus.
Yeah, plus or more. So I'm assuming that this formula is for one specific product.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you have an option of either doing that, which is purchasing the formula, or mm-hmm, just going in and buying a private label. Now, a private label, I'm assuming, would be if me, myself, and let's say three other stylists, mm-hmm, decide that we want to start selling some type of moisturizing shampoo. Mm-hmm. Well, all four of us mm-hmm can go to a particular private label industry and say, okay, we want shampoo. So they will just scoop the shampoo out of a huge barrel, mm-hmm, and put it into four different containers, mm-hmm, and then each of us will label the four containers with our private label. So let's say, for example, me, I label mine Profit and Beauty, mm-hmm, you label yours Haven Research, mm-hmm, somebody else labels theirs Anderson Products, mm-hmm, but it's the exact same products in each container, except we are putting our own name on it. So that, yes, is what's considered private labeling, right?
That's considered private labeling. Or if you want something modified, they will modify it for you. Say, I want a different scent. They'll modify, they will charge you. But really, that's how most of your makeup, a lot of companies don't make makeup. And they start now in this century. But previously, a lot of your makeup listed powder, shades and stuff, they have private label. They may have different grades of private label. like this lipstick to go to if you want to work in this price range, and then so and so. But then, and you're using them because you use some of the major manufacturing cosmetics already. You'd be surprised. In some places, they call it coattail the run. I know in the food industry used to do that. We say we make in, let's say, well, I won't call the name of the company, but we make it of alls, okay? And then, okay, I get this all product. Okay, then we're going to coattail the run. We're going to bring in another company. They're using the same product. We just that the list, the name is different. I mean, it's nothing new. That's nothing new.
Okay, and so then if you want to go ahead and go the formula route, then I'll just come to you and say, this is what I need. I need a hydrating shampoo, and I want these specifications. Can you create a formula for me?
Yes.
And therefore, that particular product will have will be a little bit different than one that just comes from a big barrel of products that can go to any particular individual or any particular business where they can slap their own label onto it, correct?
Yes, yes.
Okay, well, that makes a lot of sense. So what are the benefits of each? What are the pros and cons of private label and the pros and cons of doing it via your own private formula?
Private label basically is for someone who really doesn't have the expertise and they just have a good sales background, and they could basically sell anything. They can make it, to make the customer believe that it is something unique. And it could be a unique formula. It's just that, you know, they don't have the money to invest to go the $3,000 startup money, because, you know, there's other funds that you have to pay for too, that will build their company. They're only working on a slight budget. And many times it's not the product that's the main item. I'm just talking about in general. That's what I tell people. Marketing and strategies are number one. If you have a good, consistent quality product, is good. But that's never number, because we could name some product out there that's not all that great, but something about it you may like, or it's always available. Okay, so it's basically to someone who wanted to put something out and really doesn't have the capital to invest in for the startup. And I say you'd be surprised of a lot of product out here, whether it's food, cosmetic, clothing, or whatever, they do private contract work. Okay, then you have when you own your own, it's more like that's your baby. You know, you're dedicating it. You put the money and the time in it. You had something specific that you wanted to handle, because maybe that basic shampoo just didn't get what you want. So now you own it, and you could take it from shop to shop. If you were to have your product private label at company at HRC, and for some reason HRC no longer making it, the product anymore. Now I've seen this happen several times. Then the company, you have to move your product to somebody else. Can you move your formula? No, you cannot move your formula, because the formula belongs to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So now with a private label, how expensive is it to get started? So if a person wanted to start selling, let's say, a shampoo and conditioner combination, or if they wanted to start selling some type of serum, how expensive is it to actually get started?
It all depends on the company and how they have it broken down. Some people may say, and they really did this when they did the skincare line. There was a couple of private label companies did this, because a lot of people weren't doing skincare. They may say you want to buy six bottles or a dozen. They may speak in dozens, a dozen, 24. And so therefore you're not paying quite a large sum to buy the private label. Or some may say they private label this formula, and then you have to buy the amount for that formula. But it varies. It's not going to be a high price. You know, they already have the formula there. And if more than likely you buy it in the same container, or, you know, if I have to take it and put it into a different container than what somebody else has. So you generally could do it in dozens.
Okay.
In some places.
Now, one thing that you said that to me was very striking was that it's not really about private label or about formula. It's all about marketing. And that is so true, because I can have a product that is better than another product, but nobody knows who I am. And if I'm not able to get out there and market it, and even if I do try to market it, no one knows who I am. So they'll look at the product and say, well, you know, I may give it a try. It depends on how, it's going to depend on how much marketing I put into it. Now, that same product, exact same product, can be pushed by, let's say, Beyonce. Let's say she endorses that product. And it's going to fly off the shelf. And then for some reason, people are going to say, oh my God, this product is fabulous. When I use it, it does this, 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 this. It's almost like a mental thing. And meanwhile, I have the exact same product that I'm trying to sell, and I can't get someone to give me a dollar for the product. So I think it really does, it does come down to the ability to market, and then also depending upon who's pushing the product. But, you know, if you're good at marketing, and you can sell something, you can take a product that is not even that good and get people to believe that it's great, and they'll buy your product.
Yeah, I'm a strong believer on marketing strategy. People say, well, Facebook is a tool. Your strategy, what is your strategy? When I learned that there's a toy coming out called Slinky, and I lived on flat land in Savannah, where I didn't have any steps in my, you know, where I live, but it sold. It still sells. There's some other toys or objects out here that sell. What is it? And even though people may say, oh, this is a nostalgia toy or whatever, yeah, that's why it sells. The nostalgia candy sells. See, you're trying to target a market. People think they have to try to sell to everyone. My product doesn't go to everyone. Okay? It's not intended to go anywhere. That's why you get different stores out here. And it's not shunning one store versus the other. It's just that you get different stores and people go into different things. Some people just go into the store for the environment, the atmosphere. Some people like whatever they like. You know, so you try to figure out who my market. You could take that same cream. I can make a cream, a salve, and I could take it and put a nice sensual sex fragrance in it, and it could go into one environment. Then I could put one that give you a peppermint or a healthy food scent. Same product, but different targets.
That is so true. You need to
think of who you want to sell that product. They do it every day. In fact, I said this, the high school I was working with last week, I was telling them that. I said, you know, the clothes that you have, they type in somebody's name, and then again, they get, okay, now we're going to do somebody else's name, and they start doing that. Even the electronics, the parts, I went to a place, and the same parts for the computer. You may add something a little different here and there. Well, the front parts, you know, is going to be different because you know, have to have the company name on it. But it's all about the marketing.
It is. And we'll get back into marketing later on. Okay. So I have a couple of questions for you about that. But let's go back to that cursed word that I was talking about earlier. I'm obsessed with healthy eating. So I cringe when I look at food labels and I see preservatives. Now, I literally stay away from foods that contain preservatives. However, I know that products and some foods do need to have some sort of preservative in order for them to have any form of shelf life. So explain to us the need for preservatives in certain products and the concerns that some people like myself have when it comes to preservatives.
No, that probably brought me back into the industry, because for a minute I was teaching computers. I cringe when people say they don't want preservatives. Now, we are on the opposite sides, but I think we have the same intent. The intent that's true, some places they're over-preserved. They may put more than, if this doesn't write, this put a little bit more. When I got introduced to preservative, when I was in the industry, cosmetic part, and there was something called the GRAS list, GRAS, generally recognized as safe. It still exists. what the industry really didn't do a lot of research, just that it'd been around for a minute, just put it on the grads list. Because a lot of things is not dedicated to, you know, to having this lab to check out certain things. I was introduced to the parabens. Yes, the parabens. And that company I was working with, they really dealt with methyl and propyl paraben. There was a butyl paraben also, but we didn't deal with that. And that's basically all that we used. Then we had to use another one, was called Jamar 115. That's the trade name. That's Amadira urea. And years later, I asked my supervisor, you know, why did they start using preservatives in shampoo? Because isn't the right for shampoo to clean? Why are we using preservative? He thought about it. It was an interesting question. And he said, you know what, Margaret? Because we start putting protein in it. Do you understand that protein causes bacteria? Not causes bacteria. It's a good medium, let me put it. It's a good medium for bacteria to grow. So it means that preservatives, what it does, it stop or inhibits the growth. Part of the job I had there was that we took the product and we made, and we took it out to outside lab, and we did a challenge test. Now, a challenge test different for what you call a total plate count, TPTC. Okay. When you do a total plate count, you take the product and you put it into some agar. You probably did this in microbiology or science labs years ago. And you saw the bacteria grow. Bacteria will grow. When bacteria would grow, it'd take over. And we see them in diseases. We see them in markings. Okay, so we don't want that scarring or marking or disease or bacteria to grow. The challenge test was that you populate the product with bacteria. And there's five of them that the government really look after. E. coli is one of them. Yes, E. coli. So that's what preservative stops. It's supposed to stop the growth of E. coli. So you put these five bacteria in, Staphylococcus aureus is another one. You put the bacteria in, and hopefully on a chart, it's supposed to level off or die. It's not supposed to grow. So when we say we don't want a staph infection, that's what we're talking about. That's what bacteria would do for you. I mean, bactericide would do for you. It kills, C-I-D-E. It kills any form of bacteria. So when I made product that people had to put their finger in constantly, I would increase my preservative. So it's a challenge. What do you want? You want bacteria or you don't? Or are you going to keep it in the refrigerator? Because the refrigerator helps keep the bacteria to some degree. But you know that's not true, because when you open up your refrigerator, how many moldy stuff have you taken out?
A lot.
So, food, yeah. So when, and I guess you could say, yeah, she's really into this. So I'm talking to her now, I apologize. But I was saying, we have to realize that, yeah, you know, one thing about the movements have done, it made the scientific field become more cautious, because sometimes we get this, you know, maybe say, okay, we just can't throw anything out. We got to really do some tests. We really have to make sure and monitor. And there's certain companies you can always buy some preservatives from, because they were known for making it, preservatives. But to not have it, that means that moldy stuff you've been throwing out in your refrigerator, you don't throw it out. I know cheese is mold. I can hear mama right now. Yeah, I know mama, cheese mold. but don't throw it out. Just eat it then. That's what preservatives does. It stops the growth of bacteria. Some bacteria are harmful. A lot of it is, and some, like, you know, used for cheese making.
And that's the reason why with foods that don't have preservatives, they don't last. Normally, because I eat a lot of foods and I cook. I try to cook most of the stuff that I cook. Mm-hmm. I tend to try to, cook stuff that's from the earth. So I don't, mm-hmm. I try to avoid, foods that have preservatives. But one thing I do know is when I do cook something, mm-hmm. I have to literally eat it within a day or two.
Yes.
Otherwise, of course, it's going to go bad. Mm-hmm. So you have control for when it comes to the food aspects, because you just, like I said, just don't go over 2 days. Now, when it comes to products, on the other hand, we want our product to last. You know, we need it to last over time. And, you know, we're not going to put up, if we're in a salon, we're not putting our products in the refrigerator, especially if these are products on the shelf for sale, if they're retail products. So I know that for sure we need preservatives in our products. And what you're saying is, regardless of whether or not it's food or whether it's a product, you know, it's just a matter of using enough to accomplish what the goal is.
Yeah. And then see, the other thing too, like you pointed out, people want, so they want it larger. Well, if you get larger, that means it's more, it's going to be more susceptible to growth. You're going to stay with you longer and you're going to open it. So some packaged and product I make, I put in small containers. So, you know, you won't have that issue. But if you get water in your product, water is a source for growth. Water, and, you know, people can say, well, I put it in the refrigerator, but that's why I point out, stuff molds in the refrigerator. You just have to be careful. It, what the community did, though, it made the scientists, I feel, a little bit more sensitive to what the people wanted, and just don't throw stuff in there. Just make sure that what we're putting in that is accommodating, that you have less of a chance of a bacteria. Okay. And people say, well, vitamin E, vitamin E is not a preservative. It's an antioxidant. It may help preserve your product, but it takes away the oxygen from your saturated, from your bonds, your chemical bonds. And so it doesn't oxidize it. It's an antioxidant. So oxygen really reduces the shelf life of a product. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So what type of ingredients do cosmetic products require? And what are some of the things that we should be aware of when ingredient shopping?
You know, it's just like I said, it's not an ingredient by itself that some people may, let me backtrack. Everybody's allergic to something, I believe. That's my take. My grandmother was supposed to be allergic to strawberries, but she would never know because she would eat a lot of strawberries. But everybody's allergic to some form of fashion. Now, certain things when they separate is one thing, certain things when they could combine. Like I said, nitrogen and glycerin, they separate. When they combine, they're nitroglycerin. So you just can't pull out an ingredient generally that would say that, hey, this is a bad product per se. Or then you got to look at the percentage and uses. Because somebody said, oh, they use sodium hydroxide just like they use in a well-known lotion. I said, yeah, but it's called a pH adjuster. Sodium hydroxide brings the acid up to another level. And that's what they use. And that's what they were using as a pH adjuster. So the same sodium hydroxide, yeah, we put on our hair. But the sodium hydroxide we put on our hair is used in a different fashion. So I hear people say, oh, that's a bad ingredient. And even they say glycerin, but I'm going to tell you one thing about glycerin. Because the one time I was kind of like, not anti-glycerin, but kind of cautious of it. But then I noticed that, you know, glycerin has a feel that the other ones just don't give. Like lanolin. Lanolin has a feel that, and it could be not only the ingredient, it could be the way that they extract the ingredient. And that's what a doctor, Wilbur and I both agreed on that one. I think how they extract it versus the lanolin itself. So you can't just, I mean, can you say can't? You have to look at the product and say, well, if you have an issue with this, and then you could investigate it from there. But I wouldn't call that. I wouldn't, you know, like people bad mouth. I've heard pros and cons on coconut oil. Then you need to be sure, is that what you got? You see, because there's adulteration in the industry. Industry is known for adulteration, meaning that you think that's really shea butter, but that's not really shea butter. That's a shea butter blend, or it looked like something that looked like shea butter. That's really the African mud river, yellow mud river.
Yellow, okay. Yeah. So what I'm hearing you say basically is that all ingredients have their purpose. So, yeah. So don't necessarily look at a particular ingredient and say, oh no, that's awful. It may have a purpose, And if you do decide to discard a particular ingredient, you understand why you're discarding it and if it makes sense. So is there any ingredients that you would say that we should stay away from, or not necessarily?
No, personally, on some of the preservatives, the DMDM, hydronone, I could deal with some of that. Was another preservative that can't even think of the name. I don't like, because I know it changes the product. Not because it changes the product. It's just that you have a feeling on it. You got to really look at it and research it. Like I said, I heard people say coconut oil. They don't like coconut oil. But are you really getting coconut oil? And there's two types of coconut oil. And then there's something called MCT. It looks like coconut oil. It's not really it. So I would say then first of all, why did you come up and say you didn't like the product? Did you use the product? How did you analyze and say it was that particular ingredient? So there's some I favor more than other. Like I like lecithin. I always did like the phospholipids because I like what they could do. I've seen them work in the product. Certain things I try to stay away from, like DMDM, yeah, hydronone, it's a preservative. They use it, it's cheap. They use that all over. I stay away from it. But you're going to find, just like a cook, you're going to have some preferences, what they like and what they don't like. I don't care for, I basically was always into the natural environment long before, because that's the way I grew up in Savannah. My great aunt did herbs. So, but in the manufacturing arena, they don't want it. The manufacturer doesn't want the natural product, because natural products don't have a long shelf life.
Exactly. Yes.
And absolutely. You got to handle it to some degree with kid gloves, especially Shea. You got to know how to mix it, because if you chill it too fast, you chill it wrong, or you let it sit, try to solidify wrong, what you're going to do, you may get crystallizations in it. So the manufacturer doesn't want to deal with that.
Right. And whenever I see a product that says all natural, mm-hmm. you know, I tend to be a little hesitant, because just like you said, when something is truly all natural, mm-hmm. the shelf life is very short. Mm-hmm. So I always wonder that when they say all natural, does that mean that there are some natural elements in the product, but they do have some preservatives to maintain or to at least extend the shelf life of that particular product?
Well, a couple of things you said there. All natural, you know, poison ivy is natural, poison oak is natural, so is lead, mercury, and arsenic. They are all natural. But we use, again, it's that marketing thing, you know, good, bad, or ugly. It's that marketing thing that make people think that, oh, it's all natural, it must be okay. And some industries, you might want to use some of them for some certain purposes, but not in the industry that I won't choose to use any of those. Natural ingredients are harder to maintain the shelf life. You shouldn't have any natural oils. Some don't have longer shelf life than others, but you shouldn't have natural products that you just use a little bit of and then you'll come back 10 years from now. I'm not exaggerating. But, you know, you have to be careful. And I said natural things, you can become allergic to it.
Okay.
Yeah. So it all depends on, you know, it's just like asking about what about children in general, and you make a blank statement. It really is about the individual person. It's all the individual ingredient. And how is it being used?
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so we've decided to start a product line or label. We've figured out how we want the product to be produced. Mm-hmm. Our manufacturer has successfully produced the products. Mm-hmm. With all that being done, now how do we choose the right packaging for our new product line? How do we brand our new line? Mm-hmm. And most important, as we discussed earlier, how do we market our products? Because without adequate marketing, nobody will know we exist. Now, we touched on this a little earlier, but let's expand on it a little bit more when it comes to branding, when it comes to packaging, and when it comes to marketing.
Yeah, and these are my pet peeves right there. You know, when you think about how product was developed previously, they had marketing, we just didn't call it that. For example, I'm going with that natural hair. And when the Afro came out, you know, the males created the Afro sheens and stuff. Because when they're Afro, the longness of the hair, they weren't used to the combing. And this is what I believe, this is my belief on the scrawny belief. And so they want something to help soften it. We were used to be having natural hair because we had our hair in plaits from day one. And so they started making product and they found that glycerin helped soften the particular item. And so they ran with that. Today, we need to do more marketing. We need to do in-depth marketing. We need to figure out exactly what we're trying to accomplish because that sets the parameter for your packaging. Going back to, and your sale, it sets everything. Most of, I'll say a larger percent should be focused on the marketing. And people use that word, just say marketing. Yeah, but what does that mean? Marketing strategy. What I mean by that, the same thing. Remember we talked about that salve. Okay, I got a salve here. I got shea butter and some other stuff in it. I got a base product. Okay, if we say that we're going to take this base product and what we're going to do, we got two or three markets. We could take it and put something sweet and sensuous in there and we're going to sell it maybe in the stores like Sephora, what have you. We're going to choose, based on if it's going in Sephora, now we know what type of packaging we're going to get. Okay? We're going to know how it's going to look. Now we say we'll take the same sap, same base, and we're going to take it and we're going to sell it in the health food market. And it's going to be aimed towards the outdoorsman or woman. Okay, so we gonna bring in the sense. What sense do you think we ought to use? Should it be the designer sense? No. More than likely, it's gonna be what? Your essential oils, your cedarwood, your woodsy fragrance, then maybe a floral, and we can put it in. Now, what type of container are we gonna do? Because there's different containers out here. There's links you could go to. And say, okay, if we're going to sell it there, it's going to be a rugged type thing, outdoor stuff. Maybe we need to put it into a tin can. Well, the Sephora one is an upscale Macy's, Sephora, that type of thing. Then it would have maybe your acrylic type jar, real crystal looking, and the fonts and the, but all that is decided at the beginning. The whole the marketing strategy should be the plan. And everything, and then once they turn it loose, then it will flow. I shared this information with a gentleman. He was getting into the market. He had business knowledge, but he didn't understand the marketing. I took him to three stores. The first store was the regular beauty and barber supply chain. One of the larger ones. I can't think of the name, but there's several of them out here. I told us, look at the packaging here. Look what's here. Then I took him to Ultra. Ultra is your upscale, but it's kind of middle. He looked there. Then I took him to Sephora. And nothing in Sephora was less than $10. Okay. Now, I'm not saying it's the same product, but it can be. You just change the packaging. It's just like some cars, I'm told, they have the same engine, but on the front, one's a more exclusive car than the other. So that's where that planning comes from. And you have to get in there, and you have to really deeply plan. Our previous product was already planned because people knew what we want. When Meredith De La Guardia came up with the No Lie Relax, that was part of the team that worked with him on that. He already knew because he heard the complaints from the people saying, we want a relaxer. We don't want a sodium hydroxide relaxer. We want, you know, so he took that. So you hear, that was the marketing strategy. When the sodium hydroxide relaxer, which came out first, people want relaxers, but they didn't want to burn their hair because they were just putting sodium hydroxide blend up on top of their hair without really mixing a consistent, a consistent base. And that was it. So that's where I put the whole marketing and how to sell it and how much it should cost. Because when they came to us with a product that they want us to develop, they came to us with that. Margaret, I want you to make this knockoff, or I want you to make a product. Not Margaret, this is anyone. I want you to make a product, but it has to cost, the formula has to cost it for 8 ounces. And that was our calling card. We had the parameter. So when people come to me, I try to talk to them about their marketing, and really, generally, the contract packager doesn't really get into that. I try to focus them on that, though, But we say, because see, I work with someone and they wanted a product. I made the product, but then they were going to sell it for $5, but they were going to put it in a shiny silver cap. A shiny silver cap cost $1 and something itself at the volume he's going to get. So you're not going to make any profit. You want the person to make some form of profit. It's a business.
So basically, before you even think about branding, packaging, and marketing, you have to first determine who your audience is going to be.
Yeah, and that's part of marketing. All that marketing strategy. That's the strategy. Who's my person? You should be in a position that when if 100 people walk through that door, you're going to say, that's my customer right there.
Okay.
That's my customer.
All right.
You should be in a position to know it.
Okay. Uh-huh. So then once you determine the audience, then you're going to determine where you're going to sell it. And then all of that is going to make the difference as to how you package it, how you brand it, and how you market it.
Yes, ma'am. And so that's why HRC Now, we're focusing, we're handling things in a different way because it's still the same way, I should say. But there are so many tools out here. We're focusing on something that's called big data. They call it big data, data mining. They got so many names for this. but in essence, that's what it is. They've been doing this for years. Don't you remember the times when you buy a magazine? They said, if she liked this magazine, then she must have liked also this magazine also.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So the strategy always been there. Now that we have the accessibility to the information at the flick of a switch, that's the time when we need to go in and actually gather information. And from that information, then you can take your strategy and you can market it. The rest is going to be easier. It's just like a superstore doesn't come, any store doesn't come into a community unless they look at the people in the community. Why put this store in this community? It's not going to be supported.
Yeah, and I like your analogy with a vehicle, putting in a particular engine in a particular model, because that's what Toyota has done.
Yeah.
Toyota and Lexus, pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
But you notice when you look at the Lexus, you look at the outside of it, you look at the actual car itself, it looks a lot sleeker, it looks more costly, and it's going to appeal to a particular individual who is looking for status, a certain status in life, versus with a Toyota, it's going to appeal to a person who is more practical.
Yeah.
Exact same engine in the vehicle, but the price is different.
Yeah.
And even with, you know, sometimes where you go purchase the vehicle, the dealership, if they are selling nothing but Lexus vehicles, you'll notice when you walk into the place, the customer service is going to be different.
Yes.
The furnishing is going to be different. Everything is going to be more upscale versus with the Toyota dealership where they're just selling Toyotas and not the Lexuses. If that's a word, I don't know, but I'm going to say that anyway, then, you know, the customer service is going to be a little bit more, you know, down to earth and not so bougie, so to speak.
Yeah, because someone had a fashionable bougie car. And when she drove in and they came to meet her at the, have a seat, get some coffee. I mean, come on. I'm used to park your car over there and sit down.
You know? Exactly, right. So I guess that's the same concept with the product. So you can sell the exact same product in a safari store and the packaging is going to be like, wow, this is some wonderful packaging. Yeah. And then sell that exact same product in, let's say, Walmart or Target. The packaging is not going to be as fabulous because your Walmart client is coming for the best value price. Yeah. Your Sephora clients or is coming for the prestige of saying, oh, I bought this from Safari. Oh, the packaging is beautiful. Your Walmart client couldn't care less about packaging. It's like, oh, well, does it cost, you know, is it in my budget and is it going to do the job?
Yeah, and see, that's one of the things I think we need to remember when we design the product, because it's not for you. You're not the customer. You're making a product, but you made this because of some other people, what they wanted. Well, I was teaching at one of the colleges, And I had this class and I described to them about clothing, how it came about. There were certain patent companies, McCall, Vogue, Butterick, Simplicity. The name Simplicity already tell you what they do. They take the patent and they make it simple. Vogue was really designed, instead of a straight jacket, a straight seam, it had curves in it. Instead of having 5 pieces, it may have had 15 pieces, okay? Because it's more tailored. And that's how it went. But they told me, they said, yeah, but we're still going to buy a product because of the name. So you could play on that too. And some people do. That, again, is a marketing strategy. I want to make my product, somehow some people make their product look similar to, you see this in the food store. If this is a well-known orange juice or cream or whatever product, there's another one, they copy the look. And you're not looking because you're trying to manage your children or you're trying to just get off of work or whatever the case may be. You pick one. You pick this one. It's always on sale. Boom, put it in here. And you can't keep on going. And you say, well, you know what? How different can you get with oatmeal? You know, I'm not trying to be funny. How different can you get with certain things? Grits, all right. Certain things are classified A and B, like meat. And it's really, the meat may have more bruises on it. It may be a B classification. It's different criteria. But certain things, like how they're, but people just like the idea that you're coming out of the store, like you said, with that Sephora bag.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's all a mental game.
Yeah,
a mental game.
It's beautiful to me. It's beautiful to me. Yeah, because again, you are targeting. They may buy. You may get 10 people to buy something, but you may get 100 people to buy something on the lower end. So you break it even, maybe. I don't know. It all depends. That's where the beauty of the strategy. That's why now I'm excited that we're moving into that part. Is digest, taking information and digesting it, and see how we can utilize it. So hit the markets that are in need of a particular item.
Okay. Okay, Margaret, I'd like to thank you for agreeing to be a guest on today's show. I had a great time speaking with you and I learned a lot, and I'm sure the audience did as well. So can you share your contact information with the audience in case somebody would like to contact you, and also share with us some of the events or projects that you have in the works?
Okay, you could go to Haven Research Center. .com, and on that we have a contact page. It has a telephone number or the form. We start having people to do the form to fill out exactly what it is you want. If you want me to work coming to a school, that's under the educational area. If you want to go into contacts, if you want a formula, or you just want a consultation. Consultant work is $100 an hour, and we sit back and we talk. And generally, I ask you to write down everything you want me to answer, and I'll help and direct you. Then you come up and say, you know what, I want to further this discussion. I want to go ahead and, you know, make a formula. Then we go to the next form, and then you write down everything you want in that particular formula. Do as much research as you can. And then we make an arrangement how you can pay. Or you might say, you know what, that was good information that you talked on the consultant. I think I want to wait and, you know, on it, sit on, because I didn't know it involved as much. Because when people look, they see other people just, you know, oh, wow. Yeah, it looks like they're really doing something. So my telephone number is 678-337-8628. HavenResearchCenter@gmail.com. You can contact me there. But and I do little small bites. Small bites is a series of just information that you could come online. I think it's like $10. And if you want to know something about something, they get you started. Because yes, you can make money in here. I've worked on projects that made people $1 million to put them into business, either plans, because it's not just the product itself. It's the procedures, quality. You can have quality throughout. The field that I shunned at was the one that really made me successful. And then, you know, building out the team, right? And invest in yourself. That's not that I tell people. Pay that time, money, whatever, to go to seminars, to take little short classes. That's what I say, what's going on now that we didn't have back then. you had to kind of find out, search out classes, but now they're online. Some of the projects I'm working on now, basically a lot of people like stuff with Shea. I'm a Shea technician. I educate them on selecting the right type of Shea. I just do that in general. But I've made products with Shea or natural-based items. I told you about the anti-itch product. Some other products. You can't make claims on products. I don't push the claim making. Some people might take it and say you could do this and do that. But generally, I made most active ingredients product. When I say active ingredients, I'm talking about relaxers or thios. That's going to take a little bit more because you have to pay for a science, for a cosmetologist to test. And I really don't recommend that to anyone if they're starting out. Mm-hmm. You go to somebody who's already making relaxers and go to them and if they private label a relaxer for you. The maintenance item is not an issue because, and make sure that they're good for what they say. Relaxing. I show them how to, if they're already in business and they say, yeah, I just want to step up my facility. And I wonder if this is the right equipment. I can show you how to do that. Improve your production rate. Because I asked one girl, I said, well, what's your rate? She said 100 bottles a day. I said, we could talk. I can increase that tenfold or more. But help you buy the right equipment. They sell equipment out there, but you want to make sure it's the right one.
Great. Okay, well, thanks again, Margaret. I really appreciate you doing this interview with me. And I would like to thank everyone for listening to today's show, and I hope to catch you all next time. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you.